Hello and welcome to the Mariners Library with me, Chris Stanmore Major. And in this episode, we're continuing the book, The Venturesome Voyages of Captain Voss by Captain J.C. Voss. We're on the second book of the collection. It's called 40,000 Miles Around the World. We're on chapter 28, and this is the 19th part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner, and there for $5 a month you can help support this podcast and keep the information contained within these fantastic books easily available for the next generation. Now on with the story. Chapter 28, Johannesburg and Mac the Boar Hunter, another surprise, and success in life and how it was gained. At Johannesburg there was a great surprise in store for me. One day, when I had just finished a short explanation to a large audience, one of the members addressed me, saying, "What about the big boar on Cocos Island?" Well, this took me unawares, but a pleasant explanation followed when, looking at the speaker, I recognised the face of my old shipmate Mac, who the reader will remember was a partner in the Zora treasure cruise. At a glance, I could tell that Mac had met with success in life. "Come up and dine with me tonight," he said, and of course, I accepted the invitation. When arriving at Mac's residence, I found a most beautiful home. He was seated in an easy chair, smoking a big cigar. His wife, a handsome lady, was also present, and two sweet little children played on the floor. After an exchange of words of a more general nature, I said to Mac, "It seems to me, old boy, that you have struck oil." "Yes," was his reply, "I have, for there is more gold and diamonds in this country than on Cocos Island, and if you stop here, I will see that you also will strike a well." "I appreciate your kindness, Mac," I said, "but Johannesburg is 600 miles away from salt water, and if I took up a landsman's calling, it may prove injurious to my health and perhaps mean early death to me." At my request, Mac then gave me an outline of his experiences since we parted at Callao and related how he had reached South Africa without money. I shall state here a few particulars of what I learned that afternoon. This is going off my course, but I trust that my readers will pardon me, for the yarn is interesting enough, showing as it does what a man can accomplish by sheer force of will, once he has made up his mind. In 1898, when we had reached Peru on board the Zora, we received the first news of the South African War having begun, when Mac proclaimed emphatically, "South Africa for me, it is there that I shall shine." "Well, how will you get to South Africa without a dollar in your pocket?" Jack had asked him. "Where there is a will, there is a way," was the laconic reply. Owing to his distressed financial circumstances, Mac was unable to secure a passage to the country of his dreams, so he sailed north again in the Zora and safely reached San Diego in California. Here his tale commences, and for convenience sake I shall relate it in his own words. "When I arrived at San Diego," Mac said, "I had just enough money left to buy a railway ticket to within about 200 miles of San Francisco, and to get over this distance, I was compelled to ride brake beams and walk railway ties and do the best I could. On one occasion, I hung on for dear life to a crossbeam under a freight car while the train went along at about 40 miles an hour. My strength was giving out, and every minute I thought I would have to let go and be cut up by the wheels. However, I managed to hang on until the train halted between two stations, when a brakeman passed along to examine the axles and discovered me. He at once notified the fireman by calling out that there may be a tramp stealing a ride. Thinking that the two most likely would be too much for me, I made myself scarce. This train soon restarted, and I was obliged to foot it over the sleepers for the next 4 hours. Finally, I reached a small town, hungry and dead tired. I asked a good-natured-looking policeman whether he could direct me to a place where I might obtain food and a night's lodging. The gentleman in Uncle Sam's clothes looked at me severely and said, "Move on, move on, we don't allow tramps here." "But," I commenced to entreat. "Never mind the but," the preserver of the law cut me short. "Move on as I have told you, or I'll put you in jail and supply you with 14 days of hard labour." It was the fortnight of hard labour that I respected. Otherwise, if it was for one night only, I would have gladly availed myself of the opportunity to obtain lodging, even in jail. Walking over railway ties when tired out and hungry is hard luck, but the big policeman again put me on the march. My progress was slow, and soon after I had left the town, I saw two covered freight cars standing on a siding. The door of one of them was open, so I crawled in and laid down and was soon fast asleep. When I woke up, the door had been closed. The car evidently had been attached to a train and was travelling at a good speed. I wondered whether I was retracing my steps or whether I was thus approaching my destination. Finally, the train stopped. Looking through a crack in the door, I could see that it was daylight, and a signboard just opposite reading "Restaurant" reminded me, if that were necessary, that I must get something to eat at any cost. I called the attention of a man who happened to pass by, and the door immediately was thrown open. "What are you doing in here? Every one of you damn tramps should be in jail and break stones," was a gentleman's morning greeting. Getting away from that cheerful stranger, who threatened to put a head on me if he caught me in a car again, I made a straight course for the restaurant. On entering, I said, "Good morning, madam," to the woman behind the counter. Turning round, she at once sized me up and said, "If you want something to eat, go in the backyard and split firewood for an hour. Then I'll give you a good breakfast." I accepted the job, and after an hour's hard work, the good woman proved true to her word and provided me with a first-class meal. This made me feel much better, and when ready to leave, I thanked her for her kindness and inquired the name of the town and the distance to San Francisco. "This is Berkeley," she replied, "and it will cost you 15 cents to get to San Francisco." "Madam," I said, "I will split wood for another hour or two if you will oblige me with the 15 cents. To my surprise, she handed me my fare and said that she was well satisfied with what I had done, and added, "You have accomplished more in 1 hour than other tramps will do in a day," and I scarcely knew whether to feel flattered or angry. The same morning, I arrived at San Francisco and took up lodgings at a sailor's boarding house, the proprietor of which directed me to the shipping office he had business relations with. At 11 o'clock, I signed on as an AB in a large sailing ship bound for Liverpool for $25 a month. Here I interrupted my old friend, saying, "Excuse me, Mac, how could you sign on as an AB, for you are not an able seaman?" "Oh, quite right," was his reply, "but that is how I got into trouble." Then he proceeded with his narrative. The proprietor of the boarding house looked also after some other fellows who were to sail with me in the same ship. He handed us $5 each out of 1 month's advance, and at the same time gave sharp instruction to everyone to be on hand the next morning at 7 o'clock to go aboard. All were ready at the appointed hour, and, accompanied by the boarding house keeper and his runner, a real hard case, we went on board. On reaching the vessel's deck, I asked my host about my advance. "It is in that bundle there," he answered, pointing to a parcel of considerable dimensions. "Take it forward." His runner added, "And get ready for work." We had hardly been 10 minutes in the forecastle when the first mate appeared in the door and shouted, "Get out of this now, you fellas. Heave anchor." I had just had time enough to discover that the contents of the parcel set on board by the honourable boarding house keeper were not worth $5. But the gentleman had left the ship, and we were now ordered to heave up. Anchor up, we were taken in tow, and when outside the Golden Gate, the tug blew two whistles. Then the first mate roared out like a lion, "Loose all sail! Hurry up now and get the canvas on her! You, young fellow over there," pointing at me, "get a move on you quick and loosen the main royal and skysail." "And did you get up?" I again interrupted Mac. "Go up? How could I? I had no intention of breaking my neck." Then he continued. I was going to give my explanation by commencing, "Please excuse me, Mr. Blank," when the mate harshly attacked me. "Excuse nothing. Get up there, I tell you, and no more of your confounded back talk to me." At the same time, he rushed at me in a most threatening attitude, and like a shot I made for the rigging, just in time to keep out of his clutches. I managed to climb up as high as the main yard, and not for all the gold and diamonds in the Transvaal would I have ventured any higher. The first mate was a big, raw-boned Irishman, and meantime was busy chasing others round on the deck and up the rigging. I had been hanging on to the same ropes for dear life, and hardly 5 minutes had passed when the big mate spotted me again. The vibration of the shout he let out almost caused me to let go. Come down, you," he roared in a great rage. Talk about a man between the devil and the deep blue sea. He was I. I had no alternative but to face the brute, so I clambered down. No sooner did I touch the deck when I received such a kick that I was lifted clean into the air. He then told me to help pulling on ropes and that he would speak to me later on. By noon, we were going along under full sail, and with the exception of one man at the wheel, all hands were gathered in the forecastle for dinner, and ship and officers were discussed. One old sailor, who had shipped many years before the mast, said that if he had not been drunk, he would never have gone aboard this red-hot Nova Scotia packet. "Yes," another one remarked, sending a stealthy glance sideways at me. "The mates are regular floating devils, and anybody who does not properly understand his business will have a hot time of it." "Quite right he should," a third one declared. "A man has no right to sign on to a ship as an AB who doesn't even know how to go up and loosen a sail." At 8 o'clock, we were ordered to line up on deck when the mates would pick their watches. To my distress, I was included in with the first mate's watch. This over, we were addressed by the first mate as follows. "Now you boys, do as you're told, for if you don't, I will make you do it. The port watch takes the first watch on deck. The starboard watch goes below. You, young fella," pointing at me, "come over here, I want to speak to you." With trembling knees and a fast beating heart, I walked over to where the mate stood, expecting more trouble. It was a clear, moonlit night, and when I came near the big man, he had more power on the ship than any king has in his country. He put his right hand on my left shoulder, looking me straight in the face, and said in a serious manner, "How did you dare to board this vessel as an able seaman?" Thereupon, I told my hard luck story, and when I had finished, the mate said, in a more friendly tone, "Well, you are here, and I guess we have to take you along, but, mind you, be quick and obedient at all times." I strictly followed the chief officer's instructions and experienced little further trouble on the voyage. 4 months later, I was paid off with £15 at Liverpool. I bought some clothes and a few days later, shipped on board a steamer bound for Cape Town as a steward. When we arrived at the Cape, orders were given to the crew that no one was allowed to go ashore. However, I succeeded in effecting my escape. Having put on my best suit, I left the ship in the company of some passengers and walked up to the dock gate. Here I showed my card on which was written, "Reporter," to the guard, and I had no difficulty in getting past. Thus, I reached the goal, and though I was still poor, I entered Cape Town with the gait of a millionaire. I soon found employment and gradually worked my way up, and as you can see with your own eyes, Mac concluded, I'm now well off and in happy circumstances. "Oh, you certainly are, Mac," I assented, "and a good man will always come up in the end. But tell me, was that big boar which you shot on Cocos Island really as large as you claimed it was?" "Oh yes," his pretty wife here chimed in. "What a great time you people must have had on Cocos Island. I would have given anything to have been there. And what about that goat my husband was fighting on some other island? He tells me that the animal had horns as large as bent table legs and a beard longer than Uncle Sam's." "That is so," I affirmed. "I saw it myself." Chapter 29. What happened to the Tilikum in landlocked Pretoria, and engaging a mate again, and genuine Cape Hopers, and leaving Cape Town. A few days later, I put the Tilikum on the train and travelled to Pretoria. Arriving there, I found that my old friend, Mr. Ray, had made all the arrangements for my lodging and the exhibition of the boat. The next morning, I went to the station to see whether she had arrived. It was quite early, and the office had not yet opened. I inquired from a young man who apparently belonged to the railway staff whether he had seen a boat come in on a train. "Yes," was the reply. "She arrived last night, and after we had taken her off the car, an horse came along and kicked her head off." "A horse kicked what head off?" I demanded anxiously. "The head of the boat you were speaking about. You know, that figurehead." We then walked to where the boat lay, and sure enough, the Tilikum's figurehead had been smashed and the pieces placed on the deck. The young man closely examined the broken parts and said, "You know, Captain, this head on this hooker of yours was an awful-looking thing. A man who had a drop or two too much and happened to be confronted with it was likely to get it bad. No wonder that horse was scared. But I'm quite sure when the incident has been reported to the office, your boat will be refitted with a respectable-looking figurehead, free of charge." The figurehead had been a genuine Indian carving and therefore could not be replaced in Pretoria. However, the railway company placed a carpenter at my disposal with orders to do anything I wanted to have done with regard to my boat. So it came about that the original figurehead was replaced by one that looked a little more civilized. As to other repairs, almost nothing was required. Nevertheless, I wish to acknowledge the generosity of the railway officials in Pretoria. I met several old friends from Victoria, BC, who had come here during the war and stayed. This induced me to stop at Pretoria a good deal longer than my program allowed. There, I also had the pleasure of shaking hands with General Botha, who told me that he would rather go through another South African war than attempt to cross the Atlantic in the Tilikum. Mr. Ray introduced me to a young man of about 22 years of age by name E. Harrison, who was employed in the same office as himself. He asked me to take his young friend along as a mate to England. Mr. Harrison was a native of Gippsland, Australia. He had left Melbourne about a year previously as passenger on a steamer for South Africa. He had had very little experience, I discovered. However, my general impression was a favourable one, and I accepted his services as a mate. As he could not leave his office then, it was arranged that he should meet me in Cape Town. The day fixed for my departure came and the Tilikum was lifted onto the train, and in company of Mr. Ray, who had arranged for a furlough of 10 days, I journeyed down to East London. Here I secured a temporary mate for the run to Cape Town and sailed for Port Elizabeth, a distance of about 130 miles, arriving there after a journey of 23 hours' duration. Port Elizabeth does not possess a harbour proper, but only a roadstead, formed by a wide bay open to the southeast. There I witnessed a sight the like of which I have never seen before or since. More than 24 large square-rigged sailing vessels lay stranded high and dry on a sand beach near the city. I was informed that all these doomed vessels had been lying at anchor in the roadstead, some loading, some discharging cargo, while others had been ready for sea and just awaited orders from their owner. Suddenly, a heavy southeasterly gale had sprung up, accompanied by large breaking seas, and all these unfortunate ships were torn from their moorings and driven ashore to meet their fate. When the vessels had parted with their moorings, they had come in contact with each other. Parts of their masts and yards were carried away, while some of them were almost entirely dismantled. Others were apparently left in a fairly good condition, but one and all had abandoned the blue waters of the ocean forever, destined to be broken up on shore or to suffer slow decay. Mr. Ray had followed me by train to Port Elizabeth, and when I sailed from there, I said goodbye to this faithful friend who had a railway ticket already in his pocket to return to his home in Pretoria. He asked me once more to take good care of young Harrison and added, "I think he has got a touch of consumption, but the cruise in the Tilikum will do him some good." "Consumption," I said. "In that case, I cannot take him along." Mr. Ray, however, pleaded so strongly for his protege that I finally agreed to take him on the voyage to London, saying, "All right, the Tilikum has driven all sorts of troubles out of my former mates and at times has put even myself in proper condition. She may perhaps succeed in taking the small touch of consumption, as you call it, out of him." With this, my friend was greatly pleased, and we parted after a final handshake. The distance to Cape Town is approximately 450 miles. The weather showed good behaviour when, with a fresh northeasterly breeze, we sailed out of Algoa Bay and shaped a course towards the Cape of Good Hope. The wind kept fresh till we had Mossel Bay bearing north, and then at first became light, but soon hauled into the west and started to blow. It was the first time I had rounded the Cape, but I knew its reputation and therefore did not care to get mixed up with one of its famous westerly gales and bad seas, so I steered in for Mossel Bay. The wind was increasing fast, but by sailing under small sail and with the lee rail constantly under water, we managed to evade the gale and anchored in Mossel Bay, which is perfectly safe from westerly blows. The next morning the weather had resumed its normal condition, and the wind coming in from the east, we proceeded on our course. This lasted until we had reached the neighbourhood of Danger Point, about 45 miles from the Cape. Then the wind again hauled into the west and commenced blowing. Not knowing of any suitable place to run into for shelter, I therefore steered the boat off the land, and when we had obtained sufficient sea room, we hove to ride out the gale. After sunset, when we were below in the cabin, I asked my mate, who had sailed the ocean for many years and rounded the Cape more often than he counted fingers and toes, whether he ever saw the Flying Dutchman, which is said to haunt these waters in preference. "I have," he replied, "on several occasions, after drinking bad whiskey. But as long as you stick to a good brand, you'll never see him." During the night, the wind developed into an extremely heavy gale, and owing to a strong current setting through in the opposite direction, we experienced a bad hollow sea. At midnight, gale and seas were at their worst. Now and then a high sea would break under the bow of our little vessel, making her shiver from stem to stern. From time to time I took a turn on deck to see whether our riding light was burning and everything was in order. On one occasion, when glancing up through the scuttle, I saw the little vessel working her way apparently with great difficulty over the roaring combers. "Well, Tillicum," I said, "how do you like the Cape Hopers?" And through the howling wind and the noise of the breakers, it seemed to me an answer came. "Be at ease. I'm not afraid of them. They are not half as bad as the hind hoof of a certain horse in Pretoria." The Tillicum mastered the Cape Hope gale about as well as all previous storms. A few days later, we arrived at Cape Town, where the first man I met on landing was Mr. Harrison, who shortly before had come down from Pretoria to report himself ready to join me. A large circus building, controlled by the city authorities, was placed at my disposal for exhibiting the Tillicum. Here I kept her for 3 weeks, and during this time, nearly all the people of Cape Town came to inspect what some styled as the little Vancouver Island ship. Shortly before our departure, the Tillicum was treated to a new coat of paint, and when in the water again, made ready to cross the Atlantic to Pernambuco in Brazil. On April the 14th, equipped with full provisions, water and quite a quantity of mail for Europe on board, she lay to anchor near a small wharf a little outside of the docks. Our start had been fixed for 3 p.m. A little beforehand, the embankments began to throng with crowds who had come to witness our departure. Tugboats and other small steamers moved round us, and now and then one would come alongside and passengers would pass on board various presents. All these presents were piled up in the cabin as they came along, we being very busy then handshaking and saying goodbye. The weather was calm and beautiful. Sharp to time, one of the small steamers came to take us in tow, and accompanied by a fleet of about a dozen others, each loaded with passengers, we proceeded seaward. It was a real pleasure being thus towed out. The steamers cruised round us, and their passengers waved hats and handkerchiefs. When we were just outside Table Bay, a light breeze sprang up from the south and we set sail. The steamers whistled for the last time, and from the cheering crowds on their decks, handkerchiefs, hats and caps again went up into the air. Then all steered round to return to the harbour, while we headed for the north. Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next instalment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly. And remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner podcast, and of course, Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you're safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.